You're listening to Hearing Our Heritage, the podcast where we preserve the voices and stories of the older generation and make them accessible to younger ears. We pay tribute to those who have paved the way and learn from their lived experiences. I'm your host, Katie Pierce.
My name is Reese Walter Bandley. I was born on August the 31st, 1950 in Provo, Utah.
Reese Bandley has one of the most dramatic yet inspiring stories I've ever heard. He's had some major highs and some serious lows. He's found the strength to turn his life around on many occasions through his faith in God. He's an avid car enthusiast, burn survivor, serial entrepreneur, music lover, father, husband, and follower of Christ. His story began in Provo, Utah, where he faced real difficulties in his family life.
I have one sister that was our older sister. She is the first child and four boys. And I was the oldest of the guys. And I had three younger brothers. Both my parents, both of their parents were alive and lived close to us. My mother's parents, I walked to their house hundreds of times as a child. And out of those grandparent relationships, my maternal grandfather, his parents were alive. And my father's mother's parents were alive. I had eight grandparents until I was about 10. My father's name is Lewis Walter Bandley. And he was an accountant for Union Pacific Railroad, chief clerk at Provo. My mother, Carol Bench Bandley, was a voice and piano teacher and basically stay-at-home mom. And we just had what I thought to be a pretty normal family for the most part. But your perspective changes as you age and as you learn more about your family. I think at that time in the 50s, families were a lot more rigid. You really didn't engage in chit-chat with your parents. It was pretty much them telling you what to do. And then the follow-up, did you do what you were told? And have you done everything you were supposed to do? And that was pretty much the gist of those conversations. That was part of the 1950s culture in a family. I don't think that there was a lot of affection at that time. Things were quite proper. This was a time when my mother would not think of leaving the house without being in her best apparel and hair, nails, makeup, the rest of it, and certainly not going out into public, even as far as going to the market or downtown. And of course, for men, I don't really remember my dad being in anything but really a suit. He was working for Union Pacific Railroad, and that was a real industrial. But the minute he left work, he came home, he got cleaned up, and then he was gone. He always had a calling that I believed at the time that it was the calling that took him away from the family. In retrospection, I'm not sure that was so much the case as it was him wanting to maybe escape a little bit. I think that the family presented a struggle for him, primarily because of his war experience in the Second World War in the Pacific Theater. He was part of a group that were combat engineers, and they happened to be on an island in the Pacific called New Guinea, and he was there for 4 years. And as far as I know, they never left the island for those 4 years. And I think he was really messed up. I think he suffered both physically and psychologically beyond belief, really. And of course, that was never shared. They were expected to just come home and tough it up and be a man and all that. I don't remember ever a time when my father wasn't in a bishopric. He was in a state presidency or two for 17 years. My mother always because of her musical background. She always was the organist, or in fact, in our home, we had two pianos, a grand piano and an upright, and a full-size church organ. And that was my world. In fact, my earliest recollection was someone either singing or playing scales. That was the world I was born into. She was also a cellist, which she forced upon me in junior high, which I resented also. I had a lot of resentments. The fact that I had to do certain things. I was performing at age 3. I sang opera as a child. I was on stage before lots of people, audiences sometimes of 1,200 or more, and I was not happy about it. This is another interesting thing. Everybody thought I was such a gung-ho scout, and I love scouting, and I got my Eagle. I did well in scouting. In fact, I was awarded a scholarship by Sears Stores to go to Philmont Scout Ranch in New Mexico. And the truth of the scout relationship was that was the only legitimate way that I could get out of the house. That was my escape. That was my excuse, and that was my leverage to just go. And I did lots of scout camps. I did lots of scouting activities, but it was all really pretty much to just escape and not have to be in that family situation. Now, I'd had a really strange senior year of high school. I ended up having to take ROTC high school, that's cadet ROTC, my junior and senior years, and I had to take seminary. I graduated 4 years of seminary, but my senior year of high school, I worked full-time for Union Pacific Railroad, and that meant that I had to work graveyards. So I actually went to work at 11 o'clock at night, and I got off at 7 a.m., and I went straight to high school from work, and then when I was out of school, I went home, I had something to eat, and I went to sleep, and then I got up at about 10:30 and went to work. I did that my entire senior year. Now, the other years of high school, I was working at Heaps Brick Oven and things like that, I had paper routes and all the normal stuff.
Although Reese was working so hard outside of school, he was struggling academically. He was a smart kid, a great reader, but formal education frankly bored him.
Once I became a really good reader, which wasn't until probably about third or fourth grade, is when I really figured out books. That's all I did. I just read books. When I took the ACT, they accused me of cheating, even though I had graduated high school with probably like a D average or something. And it was because I just read. I read everything. And I love learning, but I cannot stand formal education. It is just way too slow.
Eventually, Reese's tough home environment led him to run away from home all the way to California when he was only 15 years old.
My dad, because he worked at the railroad, had a thing called a rail pass, and I could ride any train in America for free. And so I got on the California Zephyr and went to California one night really late, got up, borrowed the pass out of his wallet, and made my way to Salt Lake and went to California. I remember vividly the first night I spent on the beach in Santa Monica. These patrol guys, they come along just like, nope, you're not sleeping on the beach overnight. You can, if you want to sleep here during the day, that's fine. You can't spend the night on the beach. So I had a friend whose older brother lived in Santa Monica, and I got a job delivering newspapers and glazing donuts at a bakery. That was the summer that I turned 15. My parents thought I had lost my mind completely. I mean, they'd seen a lot of strange behavior, but that was the icing on the cake. That's just like, okay. And of course, truancy laws and all of that. I had to come back, had to go to school, had to graduate, all those things. But I tried to go every single summer and live with friends or somebody down there and just get out of Provo. I had been in California enough each summer during high school that I qualified as a resident. And so I went with a friend and we just got into a school that was, it was called College of the Desert, COD. They called it a high school with ashtrays is what they referred to it as, because you could actually smoke in class. In 68, I'd go down there to school. And then by December, I'm married. That first year after graduation, that marriage occurred in 1968. And frankly, that was just a rebellious form of protest against my parents. And that was true of my wife as well. We just got our heads together and kind of decided how we were going to make our parents really mad at us. So we got married. In fact, my parents didn't even attend. No one, I don't believe anyone in my family attended that marriage. It was in Palm Springs. And I met this person in Palm Springs at a party while I was attending College of the Desert in Palm Desert, which is just down the road from Palm Springs. But after a while, we started living together, and then our families, both families, really objected to that relationship. We actually moved from Palm Desert up to Hollywood. I was in communications at the college, and I just thought, gosh, this is really bogging down, and I'm not happy doing this. And I think that that was the underlying driving force of pretty much everything in my life at that time. If it wasn't fun, I didn't want anything to do with it. So we move up to Hollywood, and I'd met a guy through a friend in Palm Desert, and he said, yeah, the best broadcasting school in America is in Hollywood, and it's called Don Martin's. I knew him as a broadcaster and a media personality. So we moved up there, and I enrolled in school and started going to broadcasting school. I was just off Vine Street at one point. I lived on June Street by a big park, the Long Gray Park, and I could walk to school from there. And that's about the time that the marriage started coming unraveled. We were actually only physically together for about 9 months. The marriage itself, on paper, legally, lasted about 2 years.
Eventually, Reese's broadcast experience and connections made in Hollywood led him to begin working in the music and entertainment industry.
I had friends all over Lawndale and Hawthorne, and I'd met a lot of people, and I'd actually met a girl that lived on the same block as me in Provo, and her roommate was dating Stephen Stills from Crosby, Stills, and Nash, that band. And for me, this was just like being in a candy store. It was the excitement. I had grown up as a child with Broadway, singing Broadway musicals, performing Broadway musicals. And I just loved black and white movies. I loved Fred Astaire. I loved all these kind of people, you know, performers. And I just thought, this is the ultimate. And then gradually, I kind of burned out on that deal. I really enjoyed broadcasting as long as I could just play what I wanted, but I didn't realize there was going to be a guy called the program manager that actually told you what to play and when to read the news and when to do the commercials. And I just didn't like that. I didn't like that control. So that's about the time I started working for bands. I started actually just hanging out and jockeying equipment. And this was before the unions had got into the industry. You could do the work of a grip or a gaffer, and you couldn't in film, but you could in music. And so I did that. That was just a whirlwind from 68 to 71, 72. That was all just happening. Paul Butterfield, Three Dog Night, stuff like that. You know, a lot of times you're not even involved with the band. You're at some venue and you're just setting up and getting the truck unloaded. And, you know, the band comes on way later and just does their thing. And then the night's over and you get to tear it all down and put it back in the truck. It really gets kind of boring.
During his time in California, Reese really wasn't an active participant in his faith. But that all changed when he moved back to Utah.
I was only contacted by the church one time, and that's when I was living on June Street in Hollywood. But I remember these guys came to the house, The landlord lived in the basement, and my wife and I lived upstairs. And the landlord had apparently been married to an LDS woman, and he hated her, and he hated the church, and he actually tried to kill me. He had the phone cord wrapped around my neck and was choking me as hard as he could. And it was only because, you know, I was very fit. I was 19 and I just punched him out, you know, and got him off me. Well, then I had some friends come to visit me and I just got a wild hair and said, okay, I haven't been to Salt Lake for a while. I think I'll just go back to Salt Lake for a bit, with no intention of really moving permanently from LA to Utah. But as it turned out, that's pretty much what happened. And then I went back to Provo, and that's actually how I met Colleen. And strangely enough, she was still in high school. I was 3 years older than her. So she was a senior, and I'd been out of high school for 3 years. My second brother, Phil, he and I were really close. And we shared everything. We shared cars. We shared motorcycles. We shared all of our craziness. They were in the same class and they knew one another, but didn't really hang out together. I was just a partier still. And she was pretty weary. Her parents were just absolutely just no way. There is no way in heck you're going to date a guy that's divorced. He's a nut as far as we know.
When Reese returned to Utah, he made some pretty drastic changes in his life, including coming back to church and eventually serving a mission against all odds.
I think it was just being in Utah, feeling what you feel when you're just in the company of righteous people and people that are trying to be as good as they can be. I start out by asking my dad about this because he's in the state presidency and he was serving with Gordon B. Hinckley's first cousin. Marion G. Hinckley is the state president. And my dad said, oh, Reese, I don't know. I really doubt it. Son, you've been around. You've done some stuff. He said, I'll tell you what, you can talk to President Hinckley and ask him, meaning the state president, which I did. I went and talked to him, and he said, oh, boy, I don't know, Brother Bansley. That's a reach. That's out there. He said, here's what I'll do. It just happens that my cousin, Gordon, is going to be our visiting general authority. And he wasn't President Hinckley yet. He was Elder Hinckley. When he comes to our state conference in the tabernacle that is now the city center temple, well, he said, you're going to give the closing prayer in state conference. I mean, this is huge for me. It may as well have been the tabernacle in Salt Lake, as far as I was concerned. And I'm going to give the closing prayer in front of all these people, including a general authority. He said, here's what will happen. You'll give the closing prayer. When you turn around, Elder Hinckley's going to be right there, right behind you. You just say to him, Elder Hinckley, can I ask you a question? And then that's how you're going to get your answer. And I thought, oh, brother, this isn't what I had in mind. But that's exactly what happened. And when I turned around, he was already on his feet. He said, Brother Bandley, I understand you have a question for me. And that's when I asked the question. And I said, is it possible for someone to go on a mission after they've been married and divorced and kind of living a bad life? He said, Brother Bandley, I don't know of one thing that's impossible. Thank you. Shook his hand, got out of there, you know, and just like. So then I get back to the state president and he said, okay, I know what Elder Hinckley said to you. So what do you want to do? I said, well, what's the normal process? He said, well, you fill out these things, you interview with me, and then we submit them and da da da. Well, as it turned out, I had to meet with an area authority. And I had to come to Salt Lake twice and meet with him. And then I did, in fact, have to meet with Elder Hinckley. And each time I came up, I'd go to the administration building, this big granite thing with the columns. And I go in, I meet with these brethren. And each time, it was the same process. I would go in and the brother would say, let's pray. Why don't you offer the prayer, Reese? And I would. And then he'd say, do you mind if I offer a prayer now? And we're kneeling at their desk. And I remember the first time this interview situation, the first time it happened, I was so rattled that when I headed back to Provo, and I'm in my Volkswagen Bug, I missed the turn, and I'm now headed up Parley's. I'm just in the fog. I don't know where I am. And I know why I was in that state of mind was simply because he said, let's talk again in 6 months. And, you know, being as naive as I was at that time, I just thought, oh, yeah, I'm just going to go in there. We'll just have this interview, and I'm going to get my mission call, and everything's going to be great, you know. So it was actually a year plus to get to the point that a call could be extended. So I was 22 when I entered the mission field. I went to what was known as the Kansas-Missouri Mission, but it was really the Central States Mission. That's what it had been previously, and it still went from Arkansas to Wisconsin. So I served in Clinton, Iowa, Omaha, Nebraska, East St. Louis, Illinois, Independence, Missouri, Ames, and Boone, Iowa. So when I first went, J. Stuart McMaster and Clara McMaster, they were my first mission president and mission mom, and it was time for them to go home. The next couple that comes out, Graham and Mary Lou Doxey. Graham Doxey brought 11 children, and Mary Lou was pregnant with their 12th. And because I was senior elder in Independence, I became their designated babysitter for when they would tour the mission and do zone conferences and other times they were traveling.
Reese shared a sweet story that occurred after he and his wife Lynn were sealed, years after his missionary service.
Right after my wife and I were sealed, I'm in the Salt Lake Temple. I'm on a shift, and I hear this voice behind me say, Elder Bandley. And I'm thinking, Elder Bandley, this is some confused person. And I turn around and I look at this guy. He said, you don't even know me, do you? I said, I'm sorry, I don't. He goes, I'm Scott Doxey. You used to feed me peanut butter and celery sandwiches. I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, you were our babysitter in Independence. My dad was your mission president.
Very quickly after returning home, Reese and Colleen were married.
She wrote to me faithfully during my mission, and we were married 3 weeks after I returned from my mission at the Provo Temple. So the first child born to Colleen and I, we name him Brack, B-R-A-K. And he is just exactly like me. He's a car guy, and he is today. By the time he's talking, it's like Alfa Romeo Spider, BMW, Mercedes, Peugeot, Citroen. So he was born in 1975, followed 2 years later by his younger brother, Wyatt. And both these guys are just, they're just characters. They're just running and jumping and playing and bikes and any kind of anything that had wheels and just all that.
Eventually, Reese had so many different things going on in his life, and his marriage with Colleen fell apart.
There were some things that I had agreed with her that I would leave in my past and that I would never become involved with again. Obviously, some of those things, having come from hippiedom and Hollywood and broadcasting and that whole world, entertainment and concerts and whatnot. Obviously, no drugs, no alcohol, which wouldn't have fit the LDS lifestyle anyway. But in addition to that, I had promised her that I would never get back into the music industry and working with bands, even though I had already created on paper a business plan and the whole design for an audio company. but it was going to be focused on commercial sound and commercial equipment, not necessarily home audio, but airports, schools, churches, those types of installations and that level of equipment. Also, we eventually had a recording studio and rehearsal studios for bands, which was probably not the best idea because that kind of started my transitioning back into the music business. So that company was called Bandley Sound Company, and we had a recording studio. We had 9 rehearsal studios where bands would come. They would lease those spaces or rent them, and they would come and rehearse there. We had a large mobile audio CB radios and car stereos, another big group that was next door in a separate building. And so that was kind of progression. And I worked for another company, a bunch of guys at BYU. We actually produced film strips and presentations for education. The Relief Society Board was one of our clients, and home food storage was a big deal at that time. It was kind of new, and we did that for a company there in Provo and had a number of things going kind of at once. I get bored really easily, and I don't stay focused on things very well beyond inception and getting everything up and going. And once it is and it's smooth and the operation is just kind of flowing, then I tend to get bored. And so I probably had 3 or 4 different enterprises going all at the same time. That was really the crux of it because it got out of control. I mean, I had an offer from a big promoter almost immediately. The guy that owns United Concerts, he owns USANA. He said, come on up, I want to talk to you. So I'm in Provo, I drive up. In fact, Colleen went with me. She came up with me. And he said, I've got a gig for you. You're going to love this. It's only 4 months, but it was road work. You're touring. And it was Roberta Flack. And I really liked her as an artist. And I thought this would be really good. But I also knew of the promise that I'd made her. And I also knew that it was the road work that I hated most about the business, because it's insane. I mean, it's one thing to just pack up a truck and put all that gear away. It's another thing when you've got to be in another town that's 300 or 400 miles away, and you've got to be there tomorrow and set up and ready for the next performance. And I needed money. I had this sound company that was in the works. It's not making anything. And so I ended up doing Styx, James Gang, and Billy Joel 1, 2, 3 weekends. And just that started it. And then it just got out of control again, you know. And pretty soon I'm right back in the thick of it. Colleen's dad was approached by someone that I knew socially here in Salt Lake, Susie McCarty of McCarty Models and Talent. And she wanted to open an agency. She had a model talent agency here in Salt Lake, big operation, very successful. She wanted to open an agency in Provo. And she'd gone to Colleen's dad with an offer. He said, I'm not interested. You might want to talk to my daughter and her husband about it. So she did. And she kind of recognized me a little bit from our social interactions in Salt Lake. We ended up becoming her partners and opened an agency down there. And that's going on simultaneously almost. I got really interested in BMW. I met a guy at BYU TV in broadcasting, and probably because of our mutual background, I ended up buying his BMW from him. And that just set off another whole career because I became an apprentice. Then I got factory trained, and that was all just to keep my BMWs going. And then I actually opened a shop, and I imported and distributed BMW automotive parts and accessories. I had a great career in that, which is actually that led to me having a fire in my shop, and I got burned 2 days before Christmas in 1981. And I was in and out of the hospital a lot and had many grafts and surgeries. At the time I got burned, I was working in the fashion industry. And you can imagine, I mean, people just freaked. I mean, they've heard about this fire. They've heard about me, the extent of my injuries. And our partner, Susie, she never called. She never visited the hospital. Nothing. She just assumed I was going to look like all the pictures you've ever seen of a burn victim. And I didn't, because I had my brother fired the doctor that saw me initially. We got Blaine Hershey, one of the top reconstructive and plastic surgeons in the world. And that's why I look like I do. While I'm in the hospital, one night her bishop comes to see me. And we'd been separated for a while. And he said, "Reese, your wife would like you to sign these documents. She wants a divorce." Well, this arm was going to be amputated above the elbow. This finger, forefinger and thumb, were going to be amputated on the right hand. And I'm hanging from IV poles in these things that are like, they just grab as pressures on them. They hold you, just these knit things. And I'm all bandaged. I mean, I've lost part of my ear, half my nose, my lips are gone. And I said, "Well, Bishop, I think it's obvious I'm not signing anything." And he goes, "Oh, I guess you're not. Well, hey, I'll be right back. We can do this with an audio recording. You just have to give authorization." And I'm thinking, really? Your timing stinks. Anyway, I did. And long story short, 7 years later, we're divorced. I'm out of the church, and I'm right back in the thick of it. She moved to California, to Half Moon Bay, took the boys. They lived on a golf course. I saw them one time after 11 years at my mother's funeral. And then I didn't see them again until after their missions. They both served missions. And one day Colleen called me and said, "How would you feel about getting together with your sons?" And I said, "I'd love it." I had told her that I would contact her 2 years after the divorce. And at that time, I would let her know whether or not I would allow her to adopt, she and her husband adopt my children, my sons. And I felt that was worthy of consideration because I had seen blended families before, and I knew how disruptive it was when kids had a different last name than their parents. And after 2 years, I had thought about that and I had molded over in my mind, and I just thought, this is the right thing to do. They need to be a family. They need to have one name, mom, dad, kids. And I felt that it would be the right thing to do. So I allowed that. Then after 14 and a half years, she called me again. And we never spoke a word all that time. She called me and she said, "Reese, I have talked with the boys and they would like to meet you. And I think that it would be a good time to do that." I mean, they're now returned missionaries. And I said, "Great, tell them to come on up." And they did. And we spent an evening together. And my oldest son, Brack, he was 7 at the time of our separation. We look exactly the same. We sound exactly the same. We both have no hair. We're twins. Though we happen to be 25 years apart. Now, his younger brother didn't remember so many of the experiences that we had working on cars, racing up the canyon, doing crazy stuff, doing donuts, whatever, drifting. You know, these are guys that still get on BMX bikes. So they're very much like me. And this is the point being, this is without them being a part of my life for 14 and a half years. And yet when we got together, it was just like, wow, how does this happen? How does this work? We have a really, really great relationship today.
After the divorce, Reese was pretty set on not marrying again. That was until he met Lynn. However, the wedding bells did not ring immediately.
Lynn, I met at a friend who had a home at Sundance. but never lived there, but he would go there to party. And she was there, and I met her, and I didn't know who she was. I just really kind of smitten. I liked the way she looked more than anything. And she was very polite and soft-spoken, well-spoken. Turns out her husband was a bass player in one of the bands that the agency represented, and he also was renting a rehearsal studio from Bandley Sound Company in Provo. So she knew me and all this. Turns out her husband is dating one of our models. He's in an awkward situation. He's married. He's having this thing with this model. He suggested to me that I date his wife. Well, at this point in time, I'm recovering from burns. I'm working construction so I can get my strength back. I put the businesses, they're on hold or in someone else's charge. And he said, well, just give her a call and see what she thinks. Well, I did. I got an answering machine. I said, Kent said to call you. You might want to get together. And so I'm building at Snowbird, building condominiums up there. I'm up there all week, come back, and there's a message on my answering machine. And it says, this is Lynn. Give me a call. And so I did. And she said, I've changed my mind. I don't think this is a good idea. I said, okay, no problem, bye. Next weekend, I come down again, and there's another message. And she said, hi, this is Lynn. Give me a call. I think we ought to get together. And I talked to her for a minute, and I said, well, what do you want to do? Do you want me to come pick you up? We'll go get dinner or something? She goes, no, I'll just ride my bike up. She knew where I lived. She said, oh, I go by there all the time on my way to Kiwanis Park. Right off BYU campus up there, 9th East and 820 North. That's where the Bandley house was. I said, okay, well, great. I'll see you when you get here. That's how it began. I had a little ranch, a ranchette, we'll call it. Tiny little thing. It's only 11 acres. And when she left her husband, she moved in there. And then I had another home that was on 8th North in Orem. And then I had a home up here on Coatesville. But I just saw something totally different in her. Very grounded, bicycle riding. She was eating and shopping at health food stores, buying these weird types of grain and baking and doing all this stuff. And then as I found out, she had met her husband in Arizona at Apache Junction, which was a big hippie hangout, concerts out there in the middle of nowhere, kind of like Coachella. And she introduced me to music that I'd never even thought about. And then there's this other side of her that's the Mormon kind of just little homemaker, just baking and sewing and stuff. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this is wild. And the more I was around her, the more time that we spent time together, I just fell in love with her. I didn't want to be with anyone else, really. And that was pretty amazing at that point in my life.
Through the many twists and turns of his life and career, Reese was still involved in the modeling world.
And one of the models that I had recruited out of a class at BYU, I was teaching twice a semester at BYU in Provo in clothing and textiles, Jeannie Horsley. Jeannie went on to be a partner in a model agency here in Salt Lake. She was one of four partners, and she came to me and said, I want to buy a model agency? And I said, not really. And I actually asked Lynn. We weren't married, but I think we were either dating or living together. I can't remember. And she said, no way. I don't want you in that business. So of course I did. And so I buy out her partners, and I make her a partner with me for her interest in the existing agency. It's called Delegance. We got to get rid of the name. So she chose Cover, like cover models, covers of magazines, cover agency. So we formed that, and it was highly successful. And I decided that we should represent all talent. We represented a whole bunch of bands, and in our catalog, we had about 1,200 people. So it was good. And we did a lot of booking. And as long as you got people working every night and, you know, in multiple venues and all that, and doing a lot of print work when that was still a thing. ZCMI was a big client, and different ones, and TV and print and whatever. And that's kind of, that got me back in entertainment again. Drinking copious amounts of alcohol constantly and using drugs like crazy, but that was just part of the entertainment world. That was an expectation. Every dressing room, every green room, everybody backstage. And consequently, I ended up overdosing, and most people thought that was the drugs. In fact, the diagnosis was that I had died from alcohol poisoning. And so that was a wake-up call in a sense, but it didn't come immediately. I was actually in the hospital for 3 days in intensive care, 5 days in a controlled coma detox. So after 8 days at Utah Valley Regional, two of my buddies and my wife, Lynn, she knew these guys and she recruited them to come with her to have me discharged from the hospital and taken to a rehab center. And I just kind of going along with it without any intent whatsoever of doing it. And so I talked them into stopping at our condominium on the way to Logan, which is where that rehab center was. I actually stopped at the condominium just long enough to pick up some marijuana and some cocaine. And then we hit the road to Logan. I was just going to smoke and get high on the way up there. And then once we got to the hospital, I would just say, yeah, well, I've changed my mind. I don't want to do this. I don't know to this day how those words came out of my mouth. I know what caused them to. I know that that was a spiritual intervention. I know that that was the Holy Ghost that was in charge in that moment. And when this person said, well, Mr. Bandley, what are you going to do? Are you going to come in? Are you going to be my patient? And I was seriously shocked to hear my voice say yes. It took 10 days in that program before I even realized that I'd even been messed up. I was a totally functioning alcohol abuser. I really was shocked at how different I felt and how different my thinking was, and my overall sense of being and well-being. And then as the time progressed and we started to arrive week two, week three, week four, and part of that fourth week was sitting down with my siblings, my parents, and in opposing chairs face to face and really having it out with one another as to how do you feel about my behavior all these years. And I think the outcome was fairly what I expected it to be with everyone except my dad. And I think that was the first time that I'd ever heard him say he was sorry for the abuse. You know, just, he knew. And in my younger brothers, I saw definite changes in the way my dad was parenting them. And honestly, I didn't recognize him. It was that dramatic. It was that vivid that I honestly did not recognize my dad as the dad that I had. I got to a point that with him especially, and in this relationship, I just knew that he and I were identical. As rough as my childhood had been, that all changed. And I wouldn't want anyone to be left with the impression that we were not close in the end, or that just as I changed, so did my father. In fact, his change was so dramatic that even after my mission, I didn't recognize him. And that was really shocking to me, because I think somehow at that time in my life, and here I'm 22 when I go on my mission, I'm now 24 when I return from my mission, and somehow I wasn't mature enough to realize that he was growing he was maturing spiritually. He was maturing and evolving. And the person he was at the time of his death was remarkable. In fact, we had placed him in an assisted living center. My mother passed away fairly early, and that was a very tender experience as well, giving him a blessing of comfort that he would be okay there and that he would come to accept that as his home. Those experiences were just precious. There was a lot of healing. Unfortunately, my mother didn't live to see the changes in me.
For Reese, turning his life around took time, especially when it came to his relationship with the gospel of Jesus Christ.
I didn't just leave after Colleen and I divorced and then eventually come back and everything was going to be good. I vacillated. It was like a reed in the wind. I was back and forth and in and out. I think at least there was still at that time some intent on my behalf that I would one day clean up my act and come back to church and family, which I'd set dates and time frames. I'd say, okay, when I'm 36, I'll be ready. I'll just give up all this hedonistic behavior, all this craziness. And all of a sudden you're 36. Okay, well, how about 44? I'll do it when I'm 44. Never happened. But it did happen by the time I was 45. And my oldest daughter, Tori, she's quick to remind me when I talk with her about things. She's quick to remind me that, Dad, you were 48 before you had a responsible thought in your head. She's right. All I cared about was partying, just having fun. The way we got back was really interesting. In fact, after we'd lived together for 5 years? Her parents, my parents, aren't you guys ever going to get married? And we're like, no, I don't think so. Yeah, well, you really should, you know? And we did. And then after a while, I said, Lynn, I had noticed her around kids, around nephews. She comes from a big family, 5 siblings, just these big families. And even before we were married, I'm going to reunions where there are all these Bates kids are getting together, and I've met her parents, and that was really cool. I meet her dad, and the first words out of his mouth, Reese, what's your passion? What? What's your passion? Let me think. That would be music. I'm hurriedly collecting my thoughts. You know, I'm meeting this guy, this parent for the first time. I just thought, he's amazing. What a question. I mean, everyone should ask themselves that. What's your passion? In any event, I just noticed her way with kids. And I told her, I said, you know what, Lynn, you need to have a baby. She said, no. I said, why? She goes, I don't want to. I don't want kids. It took about 2 years to talk her into having a kid. And finally, we did. And by that time, we'd moved to Salt Lake. That's where most of my business is now. And we did that. And she bought it, this little condominium up by the Capitol, right on Center Street, right below the Capitol. I never saw it in the daylight because when we were supposed to move in, I went to jail. I had some suspensions, maybe revocations of driver's licenses. I really don't know that so much of that is kind of a blur, but lots of times in the county jail. And then there was somebody in my world that somehow, I'm not sure about this, but I think that they offered information about me to the authorities in order to get their own problem softened or resolved, whatever. So they had been told that I was a major player in the importing of drugs. And this was at a time when every band, every fashion model, everybody had to have drugs. It's the way it worked. In the 80s, and I've heard others, this isn't just my perspective, I've heard lots of people in the music industry, in the fashion industry, in the sports realm, all of them said that in the 80s, you could get anything you wanted with cocaine. It had more influence, more buying power than cash. It was everywhere. So I basically got set up and arrested. Of course, they found drugs in my possession, but regardless of anything, that was just basically for personal use or for guys in bands or whoever. So then they thought that they would use this as leverage against one of my business partners that they had indicted, and they expected that they were going to put pressure on me to testify against him, which I refused to do. That's when I went to prison. So I went to the point of the mountain. This is an interesting twist. The guy that took me from Utah County Jail to the point of the mountain to the Utah State Prison was a classmate from high school. And he and his twin brother had been really good friends of mine. He said, "I don't know how this happened, Reese. I just looked at the duty roster this morning and saw that I was doing prisoner transport. And I had no idea you were going to be my prisoner." So I'm in the back of a van. There's a cage between me and him. He's driving. I'm in the back. I'm handcuffed. I'm shackled to the bench I'm sitting on. And he's crying the whole way to Bluffdale. He just kept saying, "Reese, I can't believe I'm having to do this. I can't believe this is happening." And I said, "Charlie, this is on me. This has nothing to do with you." I said, "I can't think of anyone that I would rather have drive me to the prison." He was just bawling. So he drops me off. I go in, I get processed, and then they want to do the terror business. Let's just tour the hardened criminals and the worst block in the whole prison and see if we can't scare this guy to death. And I just, no big deal, just walked in. I spent some time there. Then they moved me to another unit that was called 288. Another unit after that, which was the State of Utah Diagnostic Unit. They wanted to see if I'm a psychopath or if I'm just whatever. And I spent a bunch of time there. And eventually, I had another hearing. And I remember in that hearing, and I read a report by the state psychiatrist. He said, "We recommend removing Mr. Bandley from the prison population because he has too much influence over the inmates." Yeah, I made friends with people. So then I'm taken back to Utah County Jail to finish out my sentence. 18 months. My parents didn't know any of this. They didn't know that I'd gone to prison. It just happened that my dad's cousin, his son, was a guard at the state prison. And he went to his dad and said, "Dad, do you realize Reese is at the prison?" And he turns around and tells my dad, "Well, my parents think that I have gone into a hospital for treatment for my alcoholism. They have no idea I've been arrested and indicted on these charges." That partner of mine, by the way, that they wanted me to testify against, he did 13 years at Bastrop in Texas at that federal penitentiary. And they were constantly, these guys were hounding me, U.S. Marshals. We lost a fortune, airplanes, houses, all kinds of stuff, and trying to extort me and take over one of my businesses. And oh my gosh, that was a bad time.
Reese finished out his sentence, and he and Lynn eventually had Tori and Nicole, their two amazing daughters.
So she has Tori, and now all of these traits, all these characteristics that I saw in her just blossomed. It was just an explosion of motherhood. She was just this little mom. But as this daughter we had, Tori, she started getting like typical Bandleys, really curious and really bold. and aggressive. And Lynn said, Tori goes down to the pool now by herself, and that gate is not secure, and there's no lifeguard, and we need to move. And so Lynn starts looking in this neighborhood. And that's how we ended up here. And Tori was two or three. She'd be three. And then Lynn comes to me and said, Tori needs a sister. And I'm like, a sister? Why not a brother? You know, but it was, she needs a friend. So we had Nicole. Now, Nicole has three children of her own, an adopted fourth. Tori, never married, has lived with the same guy. He's like a son-in-law. They just grew up having a great time. And gosh, cousins, Lynn's family, big family, lots of siblings. All the siblings had lots of kids. All of these kids are incredibly intelligent. They're all well-read. They're very confident. A lot of entrepreneur type qualities. I think they had a good childhood. And more than anything, they grew up being themselves. So here we are, living here. We've been here for 6 years or so, which, by the way, was the extent of our intent. I had gotten to a point, this is after a temple marriage, serving a mission full-time, numerous callings, served in a branch, presidency at BYU, lots of experiences. I now have a daughter that's almost nine. And she starts asking questions about Jesus. I don't know. I couldn't remember. And it was frustrating. I actually got, I think, a little bit defensive. And I just said, hey, there are people that do this sort of thing full time. If you want to know about this person, Jesus Christ, why don't you just talk to them? The very next morning, there were two sisters at this door wearing the badges. Sister missionaries, one from India. We didn't even have a presence in India at this time. In any event, she invited them in. I immediately left, went out to my shop and started fussing with a car, and she ended up taking the discussions. I remember things happening to me over the course of those discussions. At first, probably the first two or three discussions, I would just stay out in my shop until they'd left. That way I wasn't in here, I wasn't involved. There were occasions when I would come in, get a drink of water, do whatever, and I would hear things as they sat here about the restored gospel, about the plan of salvation. I started hearing things that were familiar, and it wasn't just with my ears that I was hearing these things. Pretty soon, I found myself hanging out, maybe down in this other room or in the kitchen or somewhere, but I could hear the conversations. I heard those sisters give Tori the baptismal challenge, and she said yes. And I just thought, oh my goodness, what is going on? Lynn had been a part of some of those discussions, and here's the caveat. Tori turned to those sisters and said, can my dad baptize me? And they said, we don't know, but hopefully he can. We'll look into it. So now Lynn comes to me and she says, you know what happened during that discussion. What are you going to do? Well, here's the problem that all parents have. We tell our children that there is nothing in this world that we won't do for them. Without any conditions, I will do anything for you. I am always here for you. So now you have a child, and what they want is not some crazy thing. This is reasonable, and it's inherently very good. And knowing what Lynn and I both did about the church, its organization, its structure, whatever, she said, what are you going to do? Are you going to get worthy and baptize her and then just go back to your stinky ways? And I said something like, what do you mean my stinky ways? There's nothing stinky about it. But in fact, it was a really bad lifestyle for the most part, very selfish. I said, I don't know, what about you? We kept alcohol in the house. She was part of a book club. They came here, they had their wine, they read their books. She still hung out with friends of mine and hers, and they all partied. And I said, so yeah, how is this going to affect you? And so we actually quite methodically, I mean, systematically, pros and cons, which seems kind of silly in a way, but that's where we were at that time. That's how we looked at it. And we just went down the list. Are you going to pay tithing? Are you going to accept a calling? Are you going to allow the home teachers in the house? They'd been to our door before. They never got inside. Same with the visiting teachers. Same with the primary presidency. Same with the Relief Society presidency. I said, if I'm going to do this, I didn't say that I would do it. I just said, if I am going to do it, it will have to be for real. And there can't be any going back. I had done that flip-flop thing too many times. And we ended up going to the bishop over this ward. And when we walked in, I said, Bishop, I'm going to apologize in advance because what we're going to dump on you is going to be really difficult. And that's what we determined to do. And this guy, he just said, this is why I'm here. This is what bishops do. We met with him every single day for 2 weeks, and then three or four times a week for the next few. And he just got an earful when we returned to activity. And I told Lynn, I said, you know what? I don't know yet how we're going to live. I said, but if I'm going to pay tithing, it can't be paid on money that was earned by scarcely clad models walking down a runway after packing their noses with cocaine before the show. I can't pay tithing on concerts that everybody in the place is out of their minds and the profanity level is unbelievable. Actually, every business that I own or have ever owned or started was based on hedonism. That was the criteria. That's the only reason I started the business, because it was going to be super fun. And she said, well, how do you expect us to live? And I said, honestly, I don't have a clue. And I walked away from everything. When you've had $1,000 a day spending pocket money, and now you've gone to pretty much zero, she honestly thought I'd lost my mind. I did a little bit of a transition toward home theater. I actually commuted to Jackson, Wyoming for 2.5 years. And this was something that I was already accustomed to because of the entertainment business. But I'm flying up there on jets, private jets, and just hanging out with all these people that had more money than brain cells. This was at a time I'm stopping using some things, chemicals and different things, and trying to get my life in order in that way. And I had been part of a group. This was in a contract that I'd signed with Intermountain Healthcare, a program called Dayspring, which is a wonderful program. But the contract I signed said that I would remain active in their 12-step program for 2 years after I left treatment. Well, after about 6 months, I am getting so discouraged. I'm going to these meetings, and this is up at LDS Hospital, which is part of Intermountain Healthcare. And I'm listening to people and their lame excuses week after week after week of why someone caused them to drink or to use, and it was never their fault. They never owned the problem. And so I went to Intermountain Healthcare and I said, you know what? I have this other program that I'm now looking at and I'm really excited about it. It's run by the LDS Church. And I think that I want to be released from this contract with you guys. And so that was really a milestone. Very first calling was the technology specialist for the stake, which everybody just thought, oh gosh, this guy's a broadcast engineer. This is perfect. So that's what I did for about 7 years. Lynn, on the other hand, became different things like welfare assignment coordinators, just real entry-level callings to just see how do you fit in the organization and what are your skills and whatnot. Eventually, she became the primary president in the ward and the young women's president in the ward and then the state young women's president. We just got totally integrated into the church and it was wonderful. My going to work for the church is another crazy episode in and of itself because I had been to church headquarters and you can imagine, I looked pretty rough at this time. I just looked like a guy that promoted rock and roll and, you know, hung out in hotels and tour buses and drugs and alcohol, and that's how I looked. And that started to change, but that takes a long time. And so I go to downtown, go to the church office building, and walk in, talk to the HR people, human resources, and it's the main group. And they said, well, here, fill out this application, and you have a resume, and done. I provide all of that. And I don't hear anything for quite a while, and I think, well, gosh, maybe I better go back and see what's going on. And so I did, and I walk in, same person. She said, well, Mr. Branley, we don't show you having ever made application for employment. I said, oh, that's strange. I was here on this date and done. She said, well, it looks like you're going to have to do it again. This happened 3 times. Inexplicable. No one knew where the applications were, what had happened to them, anything about them. They just weren't there. Well, one day I'm at the stake center, and because of this calling that I have, I can go there anytime. And I did a lot. There were times in the week I would go over there and just sit in the chapel, just ponder and contemplate and meditate and think about what I needed to be doing. Well, I noticed there was a flyer on the bulletin board in the hall outside one of the bishop's offices, very common in most chapels. It said, wanted employees, LDS Church office building cafeteria. And so I'm thinking, this is going to be my shoe-in. And I took it right off the bulletin board. I was thinking, I don't want anybody else getting this job. So I just took it and I came home, got cleaned up, went right downtown. And I didn't even go to HR. I went through the parking underground. I walked up the ramp where the kitchen, the loading dock for the cafeteria. I walked in, I found an office and I said, I'm here about this job. And there were a couple of people standing there and they looked at each other and just cracked up. And she said, just a minute, you need to talk to the supervisor. And so I met a guy named Kay Feddersen, and we became really good buddies. He became my boss. He took that and he goes, Reese, these are in every church building in the valley. These are jobs that are always open. This is for people that clean the cafeteria after it closes. It's typically junior high and high school kids. He said, I don't think this is for you. I said, sure it is. It's exactly what I'm looking for. He goes, really? I go, yep. He said, come here. I want you to meet my boss. So we go in and meet a guy named Mike Olson. Now, years later, I'm at a reception for Mike Olson's boss. His name was Harry Jeffs. Well, at this reception, Harry comes over and he's visiting with us three. I'm no longer anything to do with food services. I'm in a whole different part of the corporation. But he turns to Mike and he said, did you guys ever tell Reese about the bet you had? And I looked at them and I said, what bet? And Harry said, you tell him, Kay. Tell him about the bet. He said, well, when you left that first day, we all wagered how long you would last. And I said, okay, what was the long deal? He said, well, that was me. He said, I figured a week. I said, Mike, what did you say? I told him you wouldn't be back the next day. So I worked at headquarters cafeteria for 7 months. Then I moved to Beehive Clothing Mill, worked in that cafeteria for 7 months, almost to the day.
Then I left that cafeteria, went to distribution services, and I worked in that cafeteria for 7 months. So 21 months in food services. It was perfect because it allowed me to see things at a very basic, very rudimentary level of this corporation. I left food services, went to work for print division. Now, church headquarters always received mail. And at this time, the mail was being opened in a room in the basement of the administration building because it was determined that that was the only mail that mattered, was mail that was coming to the Quorum of the 12, the First Presidency, and other general authorities. So they would open the mail, but only to take out donations. That's all they were looking for. And they would take all of that up to the Treasury Department in the church office building on the 15th floor. But this opening process was on this giant table. They'd just dump a pile of mail on there. And the mail was delivered to all the buildings on the church campus individually. Now, because of this event that took place, Joanne is opening mail and she finds a letter. And as she opens it, this white substance falls out on the table, and the letter reads, "Congratulations, you've just been exposed to anthrax." And bells and whistles went off, and alarms sounded, and all heck broke loose, honestly. This was in 2000, and nobody knew what to do. The next thing you know, hazmat is on the scene. The FBI is on the scene. The U.S. Postal Inspector. And now they've got Joanne outside. She's in a tent. They've foamed her. They've scrubbed her. They've administered the anthrax antidote. She's now in shock. There's helicopters flying around over the temple, and the media's got hold of this, and it's crazy. So I'm working at the print center. My boss gets a call, says, "Hey, we're taking Reese. He's coming uptown." And I've often wondered why. Did they just figure, what the heck, he's disposable, we can just whatever? I don't know why this happened. But I was taken to headquarters, and my mandate came directly from the First Presidency. This is what we're going to do. There will no longer be anyone delivering anything to this campus. We secured a property on 4th East between South Temple and First South. That became the Mail Operations Center. We started going to the post office every morning, picking up the mail, bringing it to that center. That's where it had been profiled once at the post office as we loaded it onto the truck. We'd gone through every tub, every bin, everything before it ever came to this center. Once it was there, it was inspected again, profiled. How does it look? Is there anything weird about it? Does it feel funny? Does it smell? Does it anything at all? Then it gets x-rayed. We now have a machine, just like at the airport, and the mail is opened inside biocontainment cabinets. This now is the process. Every day, every single piece of mail. It gets to the point, and this is evolving. We don't know where this is going or how it's going to end up. And I get memos, I get emails, I get all that stuff right from the First Presidency. The bishopric is copied on it. My boss is copied on it. But I'm taking my orders from the brethren. Well, it's eventually determined that they will not even receive mail at their homes. Every piece of mail going to a general authority has to come to that operations center before it's delivered. It's an operation that you just can't even imagine the scope of. And all of this now is coming, and it has to be processed just like that, because those things cannot be delayed. I remember President Monson coming to me one time, and he said, "We've got a problem with requests for ceilings." He said, "I need you to guarantee me that this type of mail, it's going to confidential records, and it's going to the office of the First Presidency. I want that process to be 4 days instead of 40 days. He said, "We can't keep people hanging wondering what's going to happen. That was just part of this whole burden. If I hadn't been part of that from the inception, I don't know that I could have walked into that situation and not been just overwhelmed. A real privilege to have had that position. And to this day, I have no idea how I happened to be that person. It's interesting because I actually met a member of church security that had known me. He was a Utah County sheriff, and he'd worked at the jail. And he remembered me from when I was an inmate. And it's like, oh my gosh. And he just looked at me and he said, you know what, Reese? He said, this is awesome. He said, I can't imagine anyone being better suited for what you do than you. You have perspective. You have insight. Nobody tricks you through all of that. And I just thought, my gosh, that is incredible.
Reese had a similar encounter, but this time inside of the temple.
I was the shift coordinator for Brethren at the Recommend Desk at the Salt Lake Temple for about 4 years. One day, a gentleman walks in, and this is on a Saturday morning, lots of weddings, lots of families, lots of gowns, lots of tuxes, and this brother comes over and extends his hand with his recommend in it to me. And we looked at each other and he goes, Reese Bandley? And I said, yes. He said, do you recognize me? And I said, I do. He goes, can I hug you? I didn't know what to think. And I walked around and I embraced this gentleman. He turns to his wife. He said, I want you to meet Reese Bandley. I'm the one that arrested him before he went to prison. Later that day, he invited me out on the grounds to take pictures with his family, his daughter's wedding. And I was just, my gosh, what's going on here? That's the pure love of Christ working the power of forgiveness. On another occasion, when I was at that recommend desk, it was during the Olympics. These five guys came to the temple, and they're in tank tops and cutoffs and big guys, husky guys, well fit. And one of the recommend desk attendants, he was greeted these guys. They came in, and I overheard him say, you can't come in here. And something prompted me to go around. I walked over to this brother, and I said, excuse me, would you mind if I just visited with these boys for a minute? I said, guys, I need to correct something that you were just told. I said, actually, you can come in here. And that, in fact, is exactly what your Father in heaven wants you to do. Now, it can't be today, but it can be whenever you're willing to prepare yourselves, and you will be welcome here. So this guy named Lars later sent me a letter to the temple. And in there, and I have this letter, I have a picture of him in his white clothing being baptized. He goes on a mission. He baptizes a young woman that goes on a mission. And after her mission, she comes to Salt Lake and goes to work in the church office building as an editor for the Friend magazine. She's the one that approached me and said, this story needs to be told. But she had gone to the Ensign editor and said, this is what I want to do. They said, okay, that's fine. Yeah, we don't really know what happens when we do things as we're impressed to do them. And it's a good lesson, I think. That's probably out of everything in my life, that's the most significant. In fact, there's something that I really enjoy, especially when I'm talking with our youth. I just ask them, what is your most prized possession out of all your stuff in life? And you get a lot of responses. And then I say, well, what do you think my most prized possession is? they might say, oh, you're BMW or you're something. I just reach in my pocket and take out my Temple Recommend. And that is the most precious thing that I possess, because without it, nothing else has any value, at least not lasting, not eternal. And I wonder really if people understand those ceilings and all the ordinances leading up to that ceiling. But that ceiling itself is the most important thing that happens. That not only brings us together, it forms a triangle. The Savior is now a part of that relationship, a part of that marriage covenant. And without it, there's no promise. There's no hope. That's the beauty of the restored gospel.
As you've heard, Reese has pretty much seen it all. He's made some serious mistakes and faced heartache. He's conquered addiction, and he's worked alongside Latter-day apostles and prophets. His life has had some incredible twists and turns that have shaped him into the man he is today. He is a happy, faithful, kind man who loves his family, loves attending the temple, and loves the Lord. A huge thank you to Reese Banley for making this episode possible and for being interviewed. If there's someone that you would like to have featured on Hearing Our Heritage, email us at hearingourheritage.com or visit our website, hearingourheritage.com.